listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jake Carlisle Larson. Coming up, a Wisconsin third grader wrote a book about her best friend's brain cancer. They both join us on the show coming up shortly.
Right now, we continue our series of interviews with the candidates running to become Wisconsin's next Supreme Court Justice.
When the primary election on February 20th rolls around, three candidates will be on the ballot, but only two will move on to the general election on April 3rd. The candidates are vying to replace Justice Michael Gableman, who announced last year that he would step down after his current 10-year term ends.
We're talking with each of the candidates this week. We turn now to Tim Burns. He's a Madison-based attorney and one of the three candidates running for Wisconsin's Supreme Court. He joins us from our studio in Milwaukee. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thank you for having me here. I'm excited to be here.
And why, first of all, are you running for a seat on Wisconsin's highest court?
Well, Rob, it's apparent to me that our democracy, both in our state and in our nation, is in danger. Wealth has been concentrated in our country just out of very different from anything we've seen in a century over the past 40 years. And it's weakened our democracy to the point that we've had a great recession that started to rival the Great Depression. And as a people, we elected a demagogue. And so I wanted to run for the Supreme Court because our courts have tremendous power in our country. Every major political issue comes before them. They take 40 to 50 cases a year in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and they use those cases to shape our economy and our political system. And I was concerned that the wrong people were shaping our economy and political system in the wrong way. And we were ending up with less opportunity, a lot less opportunity for children of people who struggle, that we were ending up with laws and court rulings concerning the photo ID law that cost Hillary Clinton the election. And I was also concerned that Donald Trump has been packing our federal court with young right-wing ideologues, and if we're going to have a protection for our rights, we would have to look at our state courts.
A lot of what you said sounds like something we might expect to hear from a candidate for a legislative post or a executive post. These Supreme Court races are officially nonpartisan, and you've been criticized for wearing your politics on the sleeve in this race. So what do you say to people who say, hey, keep the politics out of it?
Look, one of my great goals here, Rob, was to be absolutely candid with my fellow citizens. I believe in democracy, and I believe if a democracy is going to elect or appoint people to a powerful position, like a court, that those people have to be candid with voters about who they are, about what their political values are, because we all know that the political values impact decision-making on these high courts. If we just step back and think for a moment, Social Security, the minimum wage, the maximum workday, unemployment compensation, affordable health care, all of those laws had this in common. They were upheld by 5-4 decisions in the U.S. Supreme Court along political lines. Those were the very cornerstone of our protection of working families, and they almost failed in the courts. They were challenged and almost failed. We have to stop believing in this fairy tale of nonpartisan, non-political courts, because what it has meant is we've given the right wing of the Republican Party the opportunity to take over the courts by convincing people that even though a third of these court cases are about criminal procedure, criminal law, that's the business of the court. And it's simply wrong. These courts shape our economy and our political system, and they do it in a political way.
So if you are elected as a justice and a case comes before you, is your first thought, is this a law passed by the legislature in accord with the state's constitution, or does it meet your policy goals, your partisan policy goals? How do you weigh those two?
Look, I absolutely believe in the rule of law. I absolutely believe that in a democracy, judges need to make sure that the democracy, the people, through the legislature, write laws and make laws and have as much leeway as possible to do so well or do so badly. But there is a point at which judges must draw a line. And for me, that point comes down to really three or four instances where you can't let the legislature and the government just have a field day. And the first instance, if it's a specific provision of the Constitution that says no, that needs to be enforced. If, you know, constitutional values at stake and it's been trampled on, it needs to be enforced. Second instance is really those situations in which the legislature and the governor do something that impact the ability of democracy to fix it. A good example of that would be gerrymandering. If the legislature gerrymanders up a state in a radical fashion, it's hard to think that the legislature and governor is going to fix that. A court would have to intervene. The third instance would be when the legislature writes a law aimed at a group of people, say people of color, who historically have had little political power. Courts need to intervene. And I would just say my final point where courts have to really intervene, we cannot let democracy destroy itself by destroying our middle class economy, because I believe that a middle class economy is critical, mission critical for a democracy. So when you see laws aimed at workers' unions or small farms or small businesses, thriving diverse communities or public education, courts need to approach those laws with some careful scrutiny.
We're talking to Tim Burns, one of three candidates for Wisconsin's Supreme Court, with a primary election coming up later this month. And Tim, switching gears a bit, can you talk about your experience in the legal system that would help prepare you to be a Supreme Court justice?
I'm sure. In the legal system, let me start here. I am one of the top consumer insurance lawyers in the country. I have a national practice. I sue insurance companies all over the country and in some cases all over the world. And I do so sometimes in class actions for regular working people when the insurance industry steps out of line. But I also, because of my skills and experience, have been hired by numerous businesses, small and large. I know more about American business, I think it's safe to say, than anyone who has sat on this court. And I know how to stand up to big business because I've spent the last quarter of a century doing it. But I haven't become a tool of business because of my background. I'm a strong Democrat and progressive because my grandparents were Mississippi sharecroppers and my father was forced out of school in the 5th grade by poverty and my mother in the 10th grade. And I realized the only reason that I'm here today is we had a great middle class economy when I grew up, with great public schools and great public libraries where the minimum wage was set to support a working family.
And Tim, I've been asking the candidates, so when should a Supreme Court justice recuse him or herself in a case?
I am in full support of the retired judge petition that they filed, rules petition that they filed about this time last year, which said at the Supreme Court level, if party has contributed more than $10,000 to get in the judge elected, the judge shouldn't be sitting on the case. Look, we all know that with the Citizens United case, our democracy is for sale. Okay? We don't need our court system to look like it's for sale, too. But unfortunately, in Wisconsin, it very much looks like it's for sale.
Would, if someone called on you to recuse yourself, say, in a case involving a corporation or a minimum wage law, since you'd expressed political views on that outside of the court, what would you say to someone who said, okay, you should recuse yourself then?
Well, you know, let me say this, that I would take every recusal motion very seriously and treat it like any other case. I would study the party's position and my understanding of the law and my own viewpoint. But I've also been extremely careful in this campaign to talk about my political values, but not go so far as to prejudge a concrete case. And it's that, it's prejudging a concrete case that leads to recusal. It isn't expressing a view on an issue.
We have to leave it there. Thanks to Tim Burns for joining us today. Tim Burns is a Madison-based attorney and one of three candidates running for Wisconsin's Supreme Court. We talked with Sauk County Circuit Court Judge Michael Skrenick yesterday. Tomorrow at this time, we'll hear from Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Rebecca Dallet. They're both also running for the same seat. If you miss any of these interviews, we'll have them all posted online at wisconsinvote.org.
For some kids, it's hard enough to imagine something as scary as brain cancer.
But an 8-year-old New Berlin girl actually wrote a book about it.
My Friend Lincoln tells the story of Lincoln Egger, a 7-year-old West Allis boy who loves tomatoes and taekwondo and who is being treated for brain cancer.
Nadia Greenewalt wrote the 36-page book and created the cover art, too.
Lincoln and Nadia talked with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson last week from our Milwaukee studios.
Nadia, thanks for coming into the studio today.
You're welcome.
And Lincoln, I'm glad you could come too.
You're welcome.
So Nadia, tell us about writing a book. That's a big job. Why did you want to write it?
I wanted to write it because I wanted something to do and I wanted to help Lincoln.
And why were you thinking that writing the book could help Lincoln?
Because I was trying to give him money to help him pay for medical bills.
So Lincoln, what did you think when Nadia said she wanted to write a book about you?
I think it was very nice.
And why was it that you had medical bills? What's going on with you, Lincoln?
Because I had cancer and...
And do you think Nadia did a good job writing about you?
Yeah.
So, Nadia, what did you want to say in the book about Lincoln?
I wrote about him when he was 2 and what was happening and his treatments.
And, Nadia, I heard that you went along with Lincoln to his chemotherapy treatment. What was that like, seeing your friend getting his treatment?
I went there 2 times. And I thought it was going to be scary, but it wasn't.
And Lincoln, the book says that you don't like getting your chemo treatments very much. What's it like when you get them?
It's like that it hurts and it's sick on my port.
So your port is where they put the medicine in you, right?
Yeah. I get headaches and tummy aches.
And Nadia, maybe you could read us a little bit of the book, because I know you have a copy with you. Why don't you read the first page for us?
This is me, Nadia, and my friend Lincoln. I met Lincoln at school, and we used do Taekwondo together. He's 7 years old, and his favorite color is red.
And what do you two like to do together? Because, you know, I know that you think about and talk about Lincoln's cancer, but I know that you also have a lot of fun together. Lincoln, what do you like to do with Nadia?
I like to play with her and do tag with her and hide and seek.
And what about you, Nadia? What are your favorite things to do with Lincoln?
The same with Lincoln.
And if Lincoln's not feeling too well, do you guys have some things you can do together that's maybe more quiet play stuff?
When I'm not feeling good, I just hang out and chill.
Well, Nadia, do you have plans to write more books in the future? Did you like writing the book?
No. This is my only book and my only book that I will.
Is that because Lincoln is so special? This is the one book you think you want to write?
Yes.
And Lincoln, what about you? What do you think of being the topic of a whole book?
I think it's nice, and I think I like it.
And what do your friends
think? I like it very much.
You like it very much. And what do your friends and your family think about a book being written about you? You're just 7, and someone already wrote a book about you.
They think it's pretty cool, and they think it's nice.
Lincoln, what would you like people to know about kids who have cancer? What do you think's important for people to know about you and other kids that are getting treatment?
Don't be afraid. It's okay.
And so,
they're just trying to help.
And how do you like people to treat you? Do you like to be treated just like other kids?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nadia, what do you think people should know about if they know someone like Lincoln who's going through cancer?
Well, they shouldn't be afraid, and they should always believe that they would be okay.
And if people want to get a copy of the book, where can they find the book, Nadia?
Well, if you go to Facebook and type in my friend Lincoln, you can ask my mom, or you can go on Gmail, myfriendlincoln@gmail.com.
And we should tell people that Lincoln is spelled Linkin, right? So they get it right.
Yes.
So you two are friends at school, and you've done things outside of school. Do you think you'll be friends for a long time?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes? And even when you're adults, you'll be friends?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, Nadia and Lincoln, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
That was Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Bosson talking to Nadia Greenewald and Lincoln Egger last week. Nadia wrote My Friend Lincoln, which tells the story of Lincoln and his brain cancer.
Our next guest saw a common health risk in a lot of the children she treated as a doctor. Behind the symptoms the kids came in with, there was often a deeper story of difficult experiences from neglect to family alcoholism and beyond.
Adverse childhood experiences are traumatic events that kids face before the age of 18. And according to the latest research, exposure to this kind of trauma can cause mental and social problems, and it can even have a direct impact on our physical well-being. Our guest says we are on the frontier of a public health campaign that can turn the tide on the problem.
Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness and author of the book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Dr. Burke-Harris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you talk about when you started to see this as a problem? You saw kids coming in with all these different symptoms, and you started to see these common threads behind them.
It was over a decade ago when I started a pediatric clinic in San Francisco, and I was seeing lots of patients who were being referred to me for, you know, one of the most common reasons for referral was ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But when I actually, you know, did what I was trained to do and did a thorough history and physical, for a lot of my patients, I couldn't make a diagnosis of straightforward ADHD because many of my patients turned out to have a history of significant adversity. And, you know, at the bottom of the diagnostic code, you know, manual, if you look up ADHD, it says, and these symptoms are not caused by any other disorder. And that was really important. But I was also seeing kids having a lot of, you know, good old-fashioned, straightforward health problems. And I'll never forget one patient. I asked her mom whether there were any asthma triggers for her asthma. And she said, you know, her dad, her asthma tends to act up every time her dad punches a hole in the wall. And that is really what got me looking into the research about how adversity affects children's developing brains and bodies.
And there's growing research on this concept of adverse childhood experiences. Can you talk about, first of all, the kind of experiences we're talking about? What are we measuring when we ask kids and adults, for that matter, about ACEs, they call them, adverse childhood experiences?
Yeah, the term adverse childhood experiences comes from the landmark study that was done by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente now 2 decades ago. And in that study, they asked 17,500 adults about their histories of 10 categories of adverse childhood experiences. And these include physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, or growing up in a household where a parent was mentally ill, substance dependent, incarcerated, where there was parental separation or divorce, or domestic violence. And what they found was, number one, these adverse childhood experiences were incredibly common. 2/3 of their population had at least one, and 1 in 8 folks had 4 or more. But the other thing that they found was that the higher your adverse childhood experiences, the higher your risk for things like heart disease and cancer and even Alzheimer's.
Yeah, can you? Some of the statistical differences are really staggering. Can you talk about the scope of the problem for people who have a handful of these adverse childhood experiences?
For folks who have 4 or more adverse childhood experiences, they have double the risk for heart disease, double the risk for cancer, 2.5 times the risk of stroke, almost 4 times the risk of chronic lung disease. So we're not talking about, you know, a minor or a small increase in health risk. We're talking about a dramatically increased risk for 7 out of 10 of the leading causes of death in the U.S.
And I hear that and I think, okay, it makes sense. You have a rough childhood, a very difficult childhood. It may lead to, you know, poor health behaviors. You're going to smoke or drink more down the road. And that's maybe part of the story. That's not the whole story. This is actually physically changing people, even down to the level of how their genes express themselves, right?
That's right. A lot of folks thought that it was just these health behaviors. But what the research shows is that underlying this strong association is what happens to our body's biological stress response. And when kids are exposed to high doses of adversity, their stress response, their fight or flight response that releases stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, that becomes overactive. And it has difficulty turning itself off in the right way. And when that happens, it can change the structure and function of children's developing brains, their developing hormonal systems, their immune systems, and even the way their DNA is read and transcribed.
Talking to Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, her new book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Dr. Burke-Harris, I want to stay with that fight or flight response because it seems like it's really key to the story you're telling and the work you're doing. You talk about, you know, that fight or flight response can be a useful thing in certain situations. How does it go wrong in this situation of, say, abuse or a difficult household that a child is growing up in?
Well, children are especially sensitive to repeated activation of the stress response. And when kids are exposed to things like abuse or neglect, what happens is that fight or flight response is activated over and over and over again, and it begins to damage our health.
And you write that, or maybe it was a talk I saw that it's useful if we encounter a bear, you know, in early human evolution. We want that burst of cortisol and adrenaline to deal with that situation. A kid growing up in this situation, it's the same as if they encountered that bear day after day after day, maybe for years.
That's exactly right. It's, you know, listen, our health, our stress response is a normal and healthy part of our body, right? The animals that didn't evolve that system, they didn't live to reproduce. But for kids who are in a situation like abuse or neglect or domestic violence, that fight or flight response is just activated so many times a day, dozens and sometimes hundreds of times a day, that those stress hormones then begin to change the way that the brain works and the immune system works and our hormones work. And that's what leads to these long-term changes that we see, an increased risk of health problems in adulthood.
Now, so far, it seems like this is a really sad story. Kids who've already dealt with these various kinds of trauma and adverse situations, well, there's more bad news for them. It's going to have this long-term health impact. You see a potential silver lining here. This could lead, you think, to a whole new way of treating these things. What do you see happening?
This science, for me, is incredibly hopeful, because kids have been facing adversity for a very long time. And unfortunately, adversity is still going to happen. There's no way to eradicate it from our society. But what the science shows us is that there are some important things that we can do to protect children's health. And number one is screening for adverse childhood experiences. All of the research shows that when we do early detection and early intervention, kids have better outcomes. And when I'm talking about better outcomes, I'm talking about improved neurologic function, like their, you know, improved brain function. We're talking about reduced risk of illness. But that's if kids get early intervention. Right now, only 4% of pediatricians in the United States are screening for adverse childhood experiences. And that's something that needs to change. And the other thing is, once we detect it and understand it, then there are some really excellent things that we can do that already exist in our society. There are wonderful programs like the Healthy Steps program that is designed to provide supports for families and help them be able to reduce the stress that their child is exposed to. And I think that when we have this science, when we understand that the root problem is an overactive fight or flight response, right, then we begin to understand how we can target this in a smarter way. Because for a lot of kids who were being referred to me, they were being referred for attention deficit. You know, when it turns out, really, for many of my patients, they were having an overactivity of the fight or flight response. And the treatment for that is different.
We'll get into that treatment in just a bit. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is with us. She's the author of The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. She says adverse childhood experiences can be a serious health risk, and there's a lot we can do to help fix the problem.
And you can join the conversation now by calling 800-642-1234. If you've experienced childhood adversity, how did it affect your life and your health? If you work with kids as a doctor, a teacher, or a social worker, have you seen the impact of these ACEs, what they're called? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. We're talking about the role early trauma and stress can have on children and their health as they age. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is with us. Her new book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. Have you had to deal with the after effects of childhood adversity? How do you think it's affected you? If you work with the kids in healthcare, in the schools, what do you see and what do you think is needed to help them? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Burke Harris, I want to talk about how treatment might work in practice. You follow at the beginning and toward the end of the book, one of your patients you call in the book, Diego. He had a lot of these adverse childhood experiences. What kind of things did you work with him on to help manage those triggers, the things that would bring that fight or flight response back?
Well, what I talk about in The Deepest Well is, what we're doing at our center, the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco, with Diego. We specifically worked on mental health interventions, also making sure that he was getting regular exercise as part of to help to reduce stress hormones and reduce inflammation. And in addition, one of the things that the research shows us that is most powerful in buffering the effect of childhood adversity is safe, stable, and nurturing relationships. And so in Diego's case, we really also supported his mom so that she could be that source of buffering for him.
And this isn't just about kids in a lot of ways. You talk about, when you talk about this, so many adults realize that this has been a part of their life. There's a story in your book about Marjorie, the person who was pouring coffee at a talk you're giving at a conference, and you talked to her afterward. What did she say?
Yes, I was actually talking with a bunch of hospital CEOs about this issue and talking about how important it was. And at the end of this meeting, she followed me out to the elevator, and this woman who had been serving coffee to all of these hospital executives, she came to me and she said, "Hey, I just want to tell you that thing that you were talking about, those adverse childhood experiences, I have all 10 of those. And I have really struggled with my health, and I have, struggled to stay sober. And for the first time, I feel like I understand what might be going on with me." And this woman said, "Just thank you for what you're doing. Please keep doing what you're doing." And it was really powerful for me to have that experience with that woman, because I think that for a lot of us, it's just the lack of awareness. It's the lack of information about how early adversity can affect our health. That is one of the biggest obstacles. And one of the things that we've done is created a website called Stress Health, stress-health.org. So that people can learn more about childhood adversity and how it affects your health.
Want to bring on a caller now. Ellen is on the line in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Gosh, it's been a very, very long story for us. I am 67 now. I lost my sister 4 years ago, way too young. She was an abuse victim of our mother. And I believe that it was a catastrophe for our entire family. I'm getting to the point where going to lots of therapy myself and everything. I want to start opening a conversation within our family and our extended family about this, and about what happened and about why our sister and cousin died so young. And I'm wondering what you think of that, of opening the conversation within the family.
Ellen, thanks a lot for calling. I'm sorry for this difficult story and for your losses. Dr. Burke Harris, coming at this from the angle of a physician, do you see a benefit for families to start talking about these things that are really hard to talk about?
I do think that it's really important. I do think that it's really important that we begin to have these conversations in families. And I'm really happy to hear that our caller was also seeking for herself mental health. We also know that mindfulness or meditation is another intervention that can help heal the impacts of an overactive stress response. And one of the things that I would encourage is just to make sure as you're doing that process, because it can be very difficult, that you have the support that you need in case, you know, your family, in case it's guaranteed to be a difficult conversation for your family, but it's a very important one, and you have the opportunity to change the narrative and hopefully break the cycle for the next generation.
Ellen, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about adverse childhood experiences, how they affect our health. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris is with us. She's the author of the book, The Deepest Well. Back to your calls now. We have Justin with us in Appleton. Justin, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to say, Justin?
Well, there's so much to say, but I'm only going to say a little bit. And it's that this conversation is giving me shivers down my spine because I've been researching different sources of information to better my health in general. And it seems that there's been a lot of talk in the alternative areas that directly associate all these different problems with the fight or flight and the increased stress hormones and all that good stuff. And it seems as though academia, the mainstream academia, they kind of ignore it entirely. And I'm really, really glad to hear that it's getting more well-known and researched by the proper establishment. And I just want to say I'm really glad for what you're doing.
Justin, thanks for the call. Dr. Burke-Harris, obviously this is important to you. You're researching it. Do you see the wider public health world, doctors, academia, as Justin said, picking up on these ideas too?
Absolutely. I think that it's we're at the beginning of this process, but it's definitely happening. And I think that we're actually at a tipping point right now. We've actually created a virtual platform for doctors to be able to learn together about how to screen for adverse childhood experiences. It's the National Pediatric Practice Community on ACE screening, and it's at nppcaces.org. We are creating tools to help doctors be able to learn together about how to address this, because it isn't mainstream right now. We do have a lot of work to do, but it's happening slowly but surely.
Thanks a lot for the call, Justin. And Dr. Burke-Harris, as we start to wrap up, at the end of the book, you talk about what you're hoping for in the future. Can you spell out what healthcare might look at as we pay more attention to adverse childhood experiences?
Yeah, I mean, what I would love to see is a focus on prevention, on universal screening for adverse childhood experiences, on greater supports for children and families, two-generation approaches that are really looking at supporting not only the child, but also the caregiver, looking at their own history of adversity and how to break that cycle. And some of that work is happening already in Wisconsin. First Lady Tanette Walker is part of a trauma-informed care initiative, and she's been really leading some of that charge. So it's happening slowly but surely. In order to do that, we're going to need public investment, public will to make this happen. But I believe we can change outcomes for the next generation.
Dr. Burke-Harris, that's a good place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness and author of the new book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. She joined us to look at the measures we can use to help children and adults who experienced adversity and trauma in childhood to deal with the far-reaching health effects of that stress. And she's hoping that the public health world, the medical world, will take notice and start making some changes.